Today, I am speaking with Dr. Thomas Bean, psychologist and author of The Buddha's Way of Happiness, Healing Sorrow, Transforming Negative Emotion, and Finding Well-Being in the Present Moment. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Dr. Bean.
Thank you.
So this book is very much about the practice of Buddhism, and I'm wondering what is different for you about the way that Buddha practices happiness?
Years ago, there used to be signs on the highway, billboards, that would say something like, if you lived here, you'd be home now. And in the Buddhist teaching, in the understanding of Buddhist psychology, you'd say, if you lived now, you'd be home here. And so the problem is that often we're not at home in the present moment, but we're getting lost in the past or pulled into the future with our worries. So for the Buddha, the path of happiness is about being mindful, staying rooted in the here and now. The past is a kind of a ghost, a phantom, something that is already gone. The future is a kind of mirage in the distance, and we don't know what the future will really be. The present moment is where we can be alive and happy. It involves more of a sense of being content, being in touch with what's good and what's positive now, instead of the path of endless struggle and acquisition.
Now, a lot of that is around mindfulness, and you actually even start the book by saying, you know, read this in a peaceful way, take your time, don't struggle, and that the idea of practice shouldn't so much be work, it should bring you to joy. Can you tell us, talk to us a little bit more about that for people who maybe feel guilt about, I can't practice, I don't know what it means to be mindful, how can I work so hard?
Well, certainly the first thing that you discover when you attempt to be mindful or you attempt to sit and meditate for a little bit is just how busy the mind is. And we could even say that that's the first fruit of the practice. You know something, you experience something very clearly that you didn't know before. And it certainly does take some patience to begin to be present to your mind and its tricks and allow it to calm down a little bit. But if we learn to do that, and it takes a little bit of training, we can begin to experience something quite different. Something else begins to open up inside of us. And I encourage people actually to begin with small steps. I think it can be overwhelming to go from not meditating at all to go to an intensive meditative retreat where you sit all day long. And that might give you a breakthrough. It's true, but it's a little bit brutal for most of us. And so I encourage people to just start where you are. Maybe stop for a few minutes in the morning, whatever you're capable of doing, and just practice enjoying your breathing for a few moments and gradually expanding that as you come to enjoy it more without forcing or struggling. If you force or struggle your meditation practice, you may be developing bad habits that will be hard to overcome. So start where you can. And then with that as a base during the day, you can just return periodically to your mindful breathing. Just stop and breathe in and out and see what's really going on with you in that moment, just allowing yourself to be present to what's actually going on. And so in this way, you begin to sort of punctuate your day and break up some of the automaticity of our struggling and our frantic doing.
I've heard a lot of teachers say, too, if you can't even take the moment to sit down in the morning, because sometimes even the idea of that is a little bit overwhelming for busy people. It is the idea of mindfulness throughout your day. If you're taking a walk, just quieting your mind, just doing it at the most basic level before you even sit down, maybe in the shower, just really being quiet and contemplating what you have. I mean, would you also recommend small steps in that sense?
Absolutely. There are a lot of teachers nowadays who advocate what's called non-dual practice, which means, don't get involved with formal practice like formal sitting or meditation. Just see about keeping your awareness in the present moment as you do simple things like, as you say, take a walk or while you're unloading the dishes from the dishwasher, just to slow down, breathe in and out, and be aware of what your hands are doing, what your eyes are doing. And I think this, there's a good point to this. At the same time, at least for me personally, I find that that doesn't happen unless I sit for at least a little bit. Yeah. So, but your listeners can just experiment for themselves with that and see what works.
Now, you are a psychologist. You live in Albuquerque. I'm sure you meet with a lot of people, possibly many who experience depression. Why did you write this book, and why this specific way as a path to happiness?
I wrote this book, and honestly, because I originally intended to write a book about mindfulness as a way of healing depression. But when I looked at that literature, I found there's already a book by Jon Kabat-Zinn and some other psychologists that's really a wonderful book. And I said, well, I can't beat that one. So I decided I would approach it from the other angle and really make some of the same points from a different angle, which is from the angle of happiness itself. Less about the direction you're trying to move away from and more about the direction of well-being that you're trying to move into.
And you say, and actually I've read it before in a lot of places, that this is not a search for happiness. This is accessing what is already there, right?
That's a very important point, yes. Nathaniel Hawthorne has this famous quote. He says, happiness is a butterfly, which when pursued is always just beyond your grasp, but which, if you will sit down quietly, may light upon you. So it's more like that. Even though Hawthorne was not a Buddhist, a lot of people have understood this principle, that sometimes you just need to be able to slow down, sit quietly for a little bit, and open yourself to what's there. And the struggle may be the problem rather than the solution, because happiness that's based on going on acquiring things and fulfilling certain life conditions that we think we must have before we can be happy, it's really an endless circle. It's a dog chasing its tail. And it doesn't really lead anywhere, because those things are like they're like drinking salt water, and you get more and more thirsty the more you drink. So instead, you're exactly right. Stop, open, see what's there. Appreciate more deeply what is already present.
And let's get into some of the chapters of the book, because you start out and you start talking about one of our chief obstacles is our own concept of happiness. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. Well, I think our concept of happiness in our culture is based on the idea of acquisition. We believe that we have to have certain things. We have to have the right job, the right relationship, more money, a thinner body, and so on and so forth, the right car. And if we can't fulfill those things, we can't be happy. Right in our Constitution, it talks about our right to the pursuit of happiness. Mm-hmm. But perhaps the pursuit of happiness is really what's keeping us unhappy, because we keep running after it. So some people nowadays want to get rid of the whole idea of happiness. Like happiness researcher Barbara Fredrickson, she discards happiness and uses the word positivity in her research. And I think especially people who, let's say, have gone to school a long time, tend to look down a little bit on the word happiness. And I used to be that way, too. It seemed like people that were happy were just kind of shallow or something like that. But if you've lived a while, I think you realize that happiness is something very valuable, perhaps the most valuable thing, and that we can't find it in the ways our culture tries to teach us, that finding it through infinite struggle is not the way and doesn't really work.
Well, I know here in Santa Fe, we launched the Happiness Initiative, and one of our great difficulties was all of the attachments around the word happiness. And
yeah.
And we did try to think about other things. I know in Albuquerque, you all struggled with the same thing there, and yet there really is no better term. I mean, we really are talking about pure happiness here. So how can people kind of get through these obstacles, their perceptions of what that happiness is? What are some of, and I should note that in the book, the chapters, you include a lot of practices throughout the book at the end of most chapters to really mm-hmm. help people. Talk about some of those, how people can get past that concept and what kind of practices they can do.
Well, first of all, I'd say that don't get hung up on the term. The Buddha is an honorary title. It means one who's awake, and he had a number of those. One of them was Sukhata, the happy one. So he at least was okay with using that idea and viewing enlightenment itself as a kind of ultimate happiness. But if the word happiness is a barrier for someone, I'd say let go of it and use well-being, or like Fredrickson, use positivity, use whatever opens the door for you, and don't get caught in words and concepts. And then if you're seeking at all to be mindful, you will begin to notice certain things. You may notice that when you acquire some of the things that you think are important for your happiness, that sure, you do enjoy that. If you get a new car that you've been looking forward to getting it, it feels good, you enjoy driving it, and there's nothing wrong, of course, with any of that. But also a subtle anxiety can arise. When am I going to get the first scratch? When am I going to get the first thing? Maybe even worrying about making the payments and so on. So pretty soon we begin to see that while it's a good thing to have that new car, it's not an unadulterated form of happiness. And that we lose it at some point because there's an accident or it stops running for some way and needs a major overhaul, then our attachment comes out and we can see the unhappiness that is embedded in that kind of happiness. On the other hand, many people have experienced things like just sitting quietly and watching a sunset and have experienced deep feelings of contentment. And when you have that kind of happiness, I think it's something more stable and something that can't be taken away from you. So you can notice this for yourself. In Buddhist teaching, it's never about taking what the Buddha said as an authority. That's a starting place. But then you have to see for yourself whether the pursuit of happiness is really making you happy or whether it's driving you crazy.
I am speaking today with Dr. Thomas Bean. He's a psychologist and author of The Buddha's Way of Happiness, Healing Sorrow, Transforming Negative Emotion, and Finding Well-Being in the Present Moment. Now, Dr. Bean, there is a lot in Buddhism around this notion of suffering or dukkha, and that this is just part of life to accept and embrace. And you also talk about that a lot in the book and how you can't avoid it. But tell me more about this.
You're exactly right. The Buddha said at the end of a long teaching career, he said, "I haven't talked about anything except suffering and the way out of suffering." So his whole quest was about finding the way out of suffering. When people in India at that time talked about things, they talked about things in that kind of language. We in the West, in our time and place, we probably want to talk more about finding well-being than about suffering. But we can't escape suffering. We can't ultimately escape suffering, but we can escape the difficulties and painful things that arise in life. And Buddha did use the term dukkha, which is translated as suffering. But I think the best translation is actually unsatisfactoriness. Unsatisfactoriness. So long before, Mick Jagger sang about not being able to find satisfaction, the Buddha talked about this a great deal. And we actually need to be in touch with our suffering and know how to take care of it if we're going to stand a chance of finding well-being or happiness. I think of it as kind of learning to walk south by staying in touch with the North Star. You turn and walk away from the things that cause your suffering, but you have to also, on the other hand, stay very in touch with what they are and look into them deeply so you understand how these things really bring the ultimate satisfaction.
And what does cause a suffering? And you go into that a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think if you understand three things, three main insights of the Buddha, sometimes they're called the Dharma seals. And there's somewhat different lists. Sometimes there's three, sometimes there's four. But in the tradition I'm most used to, there's three. And the first one is the insight of impermanence. The nature of reality is such that everything is flowing and changing all the time. Nothing stays the same for two consecutive moments. Within 1 second, millions of red blood cells are dying in our bodies, and in that same second, millions are being born. So what we are, what everything around us really is a process of flowing and changing. And we suffer because we sometimes fight against that idea. We want to hold on to certain things and keep them the same while reality is flowing and changing. And so instead of holding on, which is so much our tendency, right, we need to be able to get with the flow. And the second concept, or insight, I should say, of the Buddha is inseparable from the first one. And that is what he called no self. It means that we are not separate from the things and people around us. We are all profoundly interconnected with everything else. This is why it doesn't make any sense ecologically or spiritually to go on and pollute the streams and oceans around us, since we ourselves are mostly water. It's a craziness to think that we could do that and do it with impunity, and it's not going to catch up with us and come into our own bodies, because everything is interconnected.
It does seem to be a difficult concept for Americans, this idea of no self, isn't it? Well, I guess all human beings.
Yes, and I think it's intentionally a difficult idea, because I think the Buddha wanted to shock you a little bit and help you to wake up, to look at things in a radically different way. But understand that he's not saying that you don't exist. He's saying that you don't exist in the way you think you normally do. And what you really are is a kind of life process that continues to unfold and is interconnected with everything else. So let go of your separate sense of self and allow yourself to experience and merge into the stream of being. And then you can find real peace and real happiness. And if you understand those first two insights very deeply, then the third one you already know, and that's called nirvana or enlightenment.
You talk about a lot of our suffering as well as these kind of habits and addictions, cravings of food, of sex, of money. This seems to be the cause of suffering for an enormous amount of the population, probably the world over, but certainly here in this culture.
Exactly, yes. The Buddha used this analogy. He talked about someone who's being dragged against his will into a pit of fire by two strong men. These are very strong people, and you don't want to go there. You don't want to be thrown into the pit of fire. You don't want to be thrown into that hellish realm. But the men are too strong. The forces of the addiction, of the habit, are too strong. And despite you're resolving to yourself that in the morning that I'm not going to overeat today or overdrink or whatever it is, you find yourself doing it again anyway. It's such a powerful force. Part of the habit is that it tends to run in an unconscious and automatic way. So I did some research years ago on helping people to stop smoking. And many of the smokers would tell me that they would go to the telephone, answer the telephone, which is one of the many things that are associated with smoking for some people, and they'd find suddenly a lit cigarette in their hand. And they didn't even know how that happened, but there it was. So these things tend to run in an automatic and unconscious way. And so, in a sense, mindfulness is the perfect antidote to that. As you begin to become more mindful, you are aware of what you're doing, and things will not run in such an automatic way. And as you do that more and more deeply, a sense of freedom can open up around these behaviors that wasn't there before. I encourage people who are struggling with a habit that they feel is destructive or addiction of some kind, slow down, be aware, and ask yourself this very important question before you engage in the behavior. Do I really want this? Do I really want this? And sometimes, if you really pay attention, you'll realize that the thing that you're engaging in is not really even pleasurable right then. And so that's one level of answering the question. If you look into it deeply, you can say, do I really want this? And at least notice that maybe you really don't right then. You might still feel compelled right then to follow through, but at least you're beginning to see things in a different way.
Well,
and if you ask that question deeply also, you can begin to see, do I really want this in the sense of, do I want everything that comes along with this?
Right.
And do I want the consequences that come down the line? Because the problem with many addictions is that the immediate consequences are very pleasurable, but the longer-term consequences are very destructive.
And I think this practice of mindfulness, I mean, certainly is much easier when things are going well, but I know, for example, coming here this morning, I was stuck in an incredible line of traffic, and I could feel the panic rising, and I could feel myself being very reactive and wanting to kind of honk and be an aggro driver. And so it seems that it's really in those situations, when you most need it, that it's most difficult to access and to remind yourself that, okay, wait a minute, this is not the reaction I should have. But it's so much easier said than done. Is it just a question of practice?
It is a question of practice. And as I said, if you lived now, you'd be home here. You could even learn to be at home in the traffic jam and be at home even with the anxiety that's arising about being late for work. But what happens is, at first, your mindfulness is not very strong. It's like a muscle that hasn't been used very much. And at first, it can't do very much. And there are a lot of things in life that overwhelm your mindfulness initially. But if you practice being mindful, and especially perhaps to being mindful of the things that are positive and nurturing around you, that muscle gets stronger and you increase your capacity to do things that you couldn't do before. And maybe even being at peace and practicing mindful breathing in that traffic situation.
I did. I thought of you. I thought of this interview.
Oh, good for you. As you say, it's not easy.
It did take me a few minutes to get to that. And I said, wait a minute, look at what you're doing. You're going to go right. You're getting all aggressive and you're about to go have an interview around mindfulness and being being conscientious. We should note that there is this increasing field of neuroscience that's looking at the way, the connection between meditation and mindfulness and happiness. So there can be an actual change in our brain chemistry, right? Not just in our habits.
Absolutely. The neurology, as I understand it, is that if we have some kind of a neurological circuit that's laid down, a pattern of emotionality or an addictive behavior pattern that's connected with certain thoughts and feelings and circumstances, that circuit may always be there, though it may weaken. And what we can do is establish a different circuit. And I think mindfulness is just that kind of circuit. It involves activation of the frontal lobes by having a strong intention to remain mindful, and then that connecting with the emotional centers of the brain. And so we can gradually create a different circuit because the brain is very flexible. And neurologists call it plastic, meaning that it can change quite a lot. So we create another circuit, and if that becomes more more the tendency for us to go, that becomes a stronger circuit, our capacity to deal with difficult things increases as well. And one day we find ourselves reacting in a difficult situation with much greater calmness and clarity and kindness, and you realize, oh, you know, just a few months ago I could not have done that. And that gives you a lot of encouragement, and you begin to see how the practice works. But at first, you might want to just start with minor irritations and so on, and see how the process works, and gradually strengthen that muscle.
We're talking today with Thomas Bean. He is the author of The Buddha's Way of Happiness. And it's really difficult to talk about real happiness without acknowledging the state of the world. And, you know, we've just authorized attacks on Syria, the climate change. And so this is obviously very present in people's minds, certainly here in New Mexico. How do we integrate that? Don't we have to have this sense of righteous anger to affect social change?
A lot of people believe that so. And I certainly understand that there's a kind of fear contained in that if we become too contented, that we will be kind of self-centered and not concerned about what's going on in the world. But mindfulness is involves being in touch with what's going on. And we are in touch with what's going on in the world. Sometimes if it's too toxic, we may need to limit that flow of information if we spend too much time watching the news. But we need to be in touch with it, and looking at it from a no-self perspective. We're in touch with the fact that as we're learning about awful things that are happening to people in Syria, for example, and what's happening to the children there, we don't experience that as something far off about other people. But because of no-self, we realize this is happening to us. There's no separation between us and these other people. And so that involves opening the heart and becoming compassionate. And I think that, for myself anyway, I think that the righteous anger that people call forth to motivate change has a lot of negative side effects. And I think, it, for one thing, we can see it at work in the polarization that is in our political climate today. Because we tend to protest in a righteous and angry way, it makes the other side become more defensive and get angry back. And the polarization just tends to feed on itself and become more and more intense with no end in sight. But there's another possible motivator that we can use, and that's the motivator of love. So people like Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., and so on, they discovered was called soul force, what Gandhi called satyagraha. And this is the power of love to change things. And the advantage of this is it has no side effects. It doesn't create the kind of backlash that anger can create.
Well, tell us a little bit more about love and compassion and how to bring that into your life. Because we know these nonviolent movements, I mean, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, I mean, this has really created a lot of change. And so that we know that this is incredibly impactful, but we also know that that passion and drive are also very necessary here.
Why not be passionate about love? Why not be passionate about pursuing kindness? You know, so you can have a really strong intention around this. I think if you look at a King or a Gandhi, they were very passionate about what
Absolutely.
They felt was the way through these things. So it wasn't about passivity. Sometimes with Eastern things, especially we in the West, we get very afraid that that this is going to lead us in a passive way. But the reality is that a lot of what we say and do without being mindful, without being clear, without being kind in our awareness, is going to cause more problems and not be a solution. An example I like to use is the Titanic. We often say, you know, you got to do something. Well, the person who was steering the Titanic did something, and he steered really hard to one side to try to avoid the iceberg that was in their path. And that was why the Titanic sunk. If he had gone straight into the iceberg, it might have flooded the first section of the boat. Some people would have drowned, but the boat wouldn't have sunk, and there would have been fewer casualties. But because he turned, he scraped so hard along the iceberg that it opened several of the compartments in the boat and reached critical mass, and the whole boat sunk. And I think that's just an illustration of sometimes, you know, taking action immediately is not the best thing. But if we wait to have clarity and kindness and consider deeply what we're doing, then I think our actions will be more on target and more effective.
I'm not sure I've ever thought of the Titanic incident in that way. You've opened a new door for me. So what can our listeners do now in daily life to be happier? You've talked about some of them, but expand on some of it. And you also end with some really great suggestions in the book on specific things people can do in their lives.
Well, I would start very simply. Find a time that is convenient for you to just sit down and do a little bit of mindful breathing. Just becoming aware of your in-breath and your out-breath. And noticing that as you just let the body breathe the way it wants to and you're not forcing it, that the sensation of breathing in is actually a pleasure. And the sensation of breathing out is a pleasure too. One that is perhaps a little subtle at first, but definitely a positive feeling. And so it's not difficult. It's not really hard labor to do that. You can enjoy it in a very pleasant way and approach it from the sense of not like, now I have to do my meditation and I have to cross this as another thing to do on my to-do list that I have to get done and cross off. But as, phew, you know, I get the opportunity to just be right here and enjoy my breathing for a little while. And do that for a comfortable period of time and gradually expand it so you might be doing a half hour a day or longer if you can. And then that's the base. And once you establish a base like that, you can keep coming back to the base during the day. And many times during the day, you can stop and pause and take 3 or 4 or 5 mindful breaths and notice what's going on inside you. You can pause sometimes between tasks, but I think even more instructive sometimes is to stop and pause and breathe in the middle of a task if you can. So in the middle of putting the dishes away out of the dishwasher, stop and breathe and become aware of that habit energy that's trying to push you around to bring that task to completion. That's very instructive. And you start to open up a little bit more freedom. So from the basis of a little bit of meditation, you stop and pause and breathe. And the third thing is practice small acts of kindness in your daily life. Even things like stopping and opening the door, which a lot of people do, or giving someone a smile, or just being courteous or polite to someone who's maybe having a bad day. You know, these things all matter.
And they multiply, right? They multiply.
And they multiply. And practice mindfulness of kindness, too. Our brains evolved in a kind of negative direction to pay a lot more attention to what's difficult. But because the brains are plastic, because they can change, we can retrain them to see more accurately. And by being mindful of kindness, we can see that there's a lot more of it in the world than we usually imagine.
And you have two other that I really like. One about reading, like using words and poetry, because this is not new. There have been people talking about this, writing about this for centuries, really. So finding a piece of poetry or some text, and you also have this notion of continuous full attention. We're so distracted these days. And mm-hmm. even just doing one thing with your full attention without checking your phone, maybe, right?
That's a really deep practice. A lot of people have the belief that they are good multitaskers and that they're capable of doing these multiple things. But when they actually do research on that subject, we find that none of us are good multitaskers. Everyone tends to believe that they're the exception if they like to multitask. But if you actually studied it, you would no doubt find that they actually become worse at the tasks that they're doing, much less efficient, making more errors, and so on. So learning, I think, to single task is a practice of mindfulness. And at first, we have to train ourselves. It might not be comfortable at first, but once you get used to it, I think you can find that is actually more enjoyable and more efficient. And by doing that one thing, you'll learn better, you'll accomplish your task better as well, and without as many mistakes.
Dr. Thomas Bean, thank you so much for being with us this morning. He is the author of The Buddha's Way of Happiness, Healing Sorrow, Transforming Negative Emotion, and Finding Well-Being in the Present Moment. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'll be speaking with Lisa Randall, the Energy Conservation Program Coordinator for the Santa Fe Public Schools. Thank you so much, Dr. Bean.
Thank you.